we'll flip over a couple of more pages in that book and find ourselves welcoming Peter Wolf back to WNEW FM.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back here. This is these call letters have played an important part in my history, way back in the early days of the Jay Giles Band, for sure.
Well, sure, back in the late '60s and on into the '70s, you spent a lot of time on the radio here with Scott, certainly with Scott Muni and Dave Herman and some other friends who are no longer involved in the radio station. But here we are,
yes,
on this January night in 1999.
Soul survivors, as they say.
Really, somebody's got to survive, you know. I mean, if somebody's got to disappear, then the balance is somebody has to survive, right?
So we try to carry the torch. I think that's our that's our motive, motive arendi.
Peter Wolf, for those people who live in a cloud somewhere, of course, for many years was the lead vocalist with the Jay Giles Band. So if you've never known that, what that man's name was, and you're not quite sure who Peter Wolf is, that's who Peter Wolf is. There has not been a Jay Giles Band for a number of years. And Peter's been living up in Boston making solo albums and has this wonderful album that came out towards the end of last year. The album called Fool's Parade, and from it we just heard this song called Turning Pages. Peter, you're originally from New York. We think of you as a Boston guy because that's where you've lived for the last, 25 or 30 years, right, or something like that, basically. But you're originally from the Bronx?
I'm a Bronx boy. Well, I was growing up by Pelham Parkway area and near the zoo. Gun Hill Road, a great area to grow up. For guys, it was a lot of, you learned the fine art of spitting, smoking cigarettes, and eating sunflower seeds.
And have you remembered all of those fine arts over the years?
And then stickball sports came in, and then goils. I, being dyslexic, the sports area never kind of attracted me much, but the goils did. Uh-huh. And it was an era when doo-wop was supreme, and people would find hallways with echoes and, this night, boom, bip, boom, and people would get together and we'd sing, and rock and roll was a very, it was new, radio was unique, and there were charismatic people on the air, and growing up in the Bronx was very much like the films that you see, Bronx Tale and even Goodfellas. It was a unique area. We'd travel around. It was a different kind of city. When I was 11, I would travel on the subway down to Times Square.
By yourself?
By myself, right, sure, to buy records at this building, this record store called Times Square Records.
It
was run by a gentleman by the name of Slim, and it was a small little store, about maybe, 12 feet by 30 feet, and he would just be stacks of records, and they would have 45s for like this expensive price of like $8. Some were even $20.
And you know what? In that small store, in those days, he could have every record that was important.
Oh,
that small store.
For us, he did.
Yeah, exactly.
And we'd all hang up on the subways, and it was actually underneath the Times building. You go down the subway steps, and there it was, all kids from New Jersey and Brooklyn and Bronx, and people all gather, and we'd all collect records and talk about music. And he would have young doo-wop groups in the back of the store, and he would broadcast on one of the AM stations on Saturday in the late afternoons. And it was quite a cultural, important place for all of us. Yeah. And then there was Hubert's Flea Circus, which was down the block.
Oh, I remember. And, sure. Tell what that is. Tell.
Well, Hubert's was this actual, they called it a little flea circus, but they had all sorts of oddities. You mm-hmm. know, in those days, they called it freaks. And it was a penny arcade. And in the back, there was a fellow with a very thin pencil mustache. And, two friends would, sort of sit on top of each other's shoulders, pretend you were, like, all of 14, and walk in, and you would see all these, like, you would see this, like, exhibit where they would say fleas that were doing these tricks, and they were empty, empty glass cases. And you'd be looking and say, where are the fleas? They're there. They're there.
See, now it's all like Disney in Times Square, It's like it's a whole new mall Times Square now.
So I heard that.
You don't have empty glasses with the naked fleas in them.
Yeah, and it was great characters. I mean, the dangers weren't really there like they are today. And there are all the penny arcades. And then for us youngins up in the Bronx, we'd come down, they had these, what they call phono recorder voice. Mm-hmm. And for 35 cents or so, you can actually make your own record. And we'd go in and do our versions of, you know, There's a Moon Out Tonight.
Now, as a kid, so you were singing doo-wop stuff as a kid.
Well, we all sang doo-wop. Yeah. I was actually a painter. When I was about 3 years old, I started scribbling over everything, every book, wall, paper. And we lived in a small tenement building up in the Bronx, very much like the apartment that was on the Honeymooners, small kitchen. And it was my mother, father, sister, who was a dancer at times with Alan Freed's Big Beat Show.
His older sister?
Right? Yes, older sister.
Yeah. She danced on that TV show, Alan Freed Show?
Yep. Yeah. And dancing, she was a really great dancer, and that's where I learned a lot of my steps from my sister. And she collected a lot of great doo-wop records and early rock and roll, so I learned a lot through her friends would come over. And so was my, she was there, and two dogs, parakeet, a couple of cats.
How many rooms? Like three rooms?
It was like two and a half
rooms. Oh, wow.
And
your dad was a musician, right?
My dad was, when he was 14, he grew up in New York. He was 14. He left home to join the Schubert Theater. And in those years, the Schuberts owned their own theaters, owned their own production companies, owned their own trains. Mm-hmm. And so you could go on the road and you would... He was in these productions called light opera, and he was what they call a chorus boy and things like
that. Oh, he's a singer.
Yeah, he was a singer and dancer in productions like Merry Widow and Student Prince, and they would leave New York, and they would stop at New Haven for two or three days, and then move on to Hartford, and move up to Springfield, Massachusetts, and then to Boston.
It was that montage in those old films of the train and the calendar, and you know, they'd go from town to town, and the map, the little line being drawn across the map in the old movies, right? That's what your dad did.
This is what he did. Yeah. And they would all, you know, have their own train, and they'd sleep in the train instead of hotels, and stay there for two or three days, and just move on to the next city. And he did that for several years and got as far west as Houston. And, I mean, you can play. I mean, you would be able to play out in New Jersey, and you just do it. The towns and the different theaters, which were then later became movie theaters.
Mm-hmm. That was like at the tail end of vaudeville.
It was. And then his brother, who managed my father, my uncle, also managed a champion baton twirler, the world's strongest man, and a gorilla, and my father. And his office was at in the Automat right next to Jack Dempsey's.
Wow.
And he was quite a character. You know, this sort of Broadway Danny Rose guy. And he would always be trying to get my dad work, and all these characters, guys who were ventriloquists and magicians and singers and dancers. And he was a champion dancer at Roseland. They would have dance contests. And that's how they made their money. They would, you know, enter these contests. And my dad eventually had a show on QXR when it first started on AM, and he was a song plugger. And it was a 15-minute show where they would have new songs, and songwriters would give the songs. The publishers would bring songs to my dad. There was a pianist, and he would play and sing the songs. And that's how they introduced a lot of the songs, because sheet music was very important in that era.
Now, while your dad was living this rather ne'er-do-well life, what was Mom doing back home?
Well, Mom was a political activist. She was a...
Really?
Yeah, she was a what we would call a... I guess I was a red diaper baby. She was very left-wing. She was involved in many of the early civil rights movements and went down to the down south. She was involved in a lot of the unionizing.
She was a teacher, too, wasn't she?
She became a teacher and had a very tough time because of the whole political era, the McCarthy era that started. Matter of fact, we didn't really have a TV in our house when we grew up, but once McCarthy hearings got on TV... she had to buy a TV.
She had to get one, sure.
She had to watch this, you know, we got to watch this guy go down.
Yeah, that was the case for a lot of lefties at the time. Yeah. That was what brought the TV into the house. For
but
a
I, but yeah. You know, with that, I got to see Woody Guthrie. I got to see the young Pete Seeger and the Weavers, Cisco Houston. I was brought down and spent a lot of time at the Little Red Schoolhouse. And so there was a lot of hootenannies, a lot of folk music was very important, Josh White. So I grew up with a lot of folk and blues almanac singers in my house, and the early Folkways and Alan Lomax recordings.
And your sister's bringing rock and roll into the house.
Right.
Your older sister's bringing doo-wop records into the house, and she's bringing the music that she's hearing on Alan Freed's dance party, where she's a dancer. And so all of this stuff is mixing up in the young Peter Wolf, whose name was not Peter Wolf. Where did the Wolf come from?
Well, Wolf came from my grandmother, who she was in the Yiddish theater, and she for a short time, and it was just a name that I was always running around, and Wolf sort of came out of sort of a nickname from her, because I had lived with her for a little bit too, and
she called you like Little Wolfie or something.
Yeah,
like that?
And she used the name Wolf, so it sort of came out of that. And then when I went up to when I was traveling around, I hitchhiked for a good long while. I ended up in Boston, and I was painting. I had a scholarship at the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts, and I was so serious about painting when I started my first band. I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll just use the name Wolf, and because I was not sure where it was going to lead and how, but I love music and the idea of performing. I remember the first time we were at a party, and there was a bunch of art students. They all had a group together, and they were doing.
What is it about art students and music, art students and rock and roll? So many of them have made that transition or have balanced both worlds. There's something about the visual arts and music that go hand in hand.
Well, it's the expressive nature. I know, like, for instance, in Germany now, a lot of the great young painters were musicians that sort of gave up music to become painters. So the reverse happened. But I think at that time, it was really a release. And when Elvis came along and the first wave of rock and rollers, there was just something so emotionally expressive about it that, plus, being a painter and working alone and just being able to be in a room with, you know, three or four or five other people and just, you know, letting loose, it's pretty powerful.
Mm. But it's the exact opposite kind of experience as far as creation is concerned. Like you say, when you're a painter, you're alone. You're by yourself. You know, and the same thing with a writer. You're very solitary. You make music with a band. You're with other people, and you're performing immediately for another group of people who are like right in the room with you. You know, you get instant feedback, instant gratification.
But I think that's the thing that attracted me was the instantaneous aspect of it, because you perform a song and there's people there, yeah, all right, yama yama yama, and you know that you did your job well. Right. A painting, you can go on, and there's this, all the self doubt, and there's certain disciplines of music, you know, trying to at least keep it close to key.
In Boston. You lived with some interesting people in Boston. I'm always fascinated to learn that people who go on to become very successful in their fields cross paths at a time when they are just starting out and relatively unknown. I read somewhere that you roomed for a while with a young filmmaker named David Lynch.
That's true.
Who was a nobody at the time, as was Peter Wolf, basically a nobody at the time. Isn't that amazing? You know, that you two guys then go on to become the filmmaker David Lynch, the rock and roller Peter Wolf. You met him where?
Well, it was a funny story. I hitched up to Boston. I had very little money. I was actually traveling around. I was going to the High School of Music and Art.
Here in the city?
Here in the city, and I was studying painting. And when it came to graduation, I really didn't have enough credits to graduate, so I actually never finished high school. And I decided to take off and get out there in the hinterlands and follow. There was a dream of people growing up in my era. There was always something very romantic about the Midwest, and just getting away from New York and getting out on the hills and getting down south and getting up in the mountains and traveling around and visiting farmlands and, you know, it was just.
And you could still do it then, too. You could put your thumb out and.
And you can go.
You could get
rides.
Truck
drivers would pick you up and you'd stop at little places. And every now and then somebody would pick you up and, you know, put his hand on your knee and go, interested in sports, young man? So you learn how,
and,
how to
and,
deal.
And Peter would say, no, no, I'm dyslexic. I'm not interested in sports.
Thank you, Vin. But I was out in Chicago and I realized that what I did was pretty incredible. Universities were very loose at that time, and I was able to sort of visit my friends going to colleges or universities and live in the dorms, or in the each dorm had a little a lounge area.
Like a common room.
Common room, yeah. Right. And I lived there and would just go into the art departments and use their art supplies. And I was in Wisconsin for a while. My sister ended up at University of Wisconsin. And I went there, and I guess I drank myself a little crazy and embarrassed her, so I was asked to sort of leave the city. And so I ended up at the University of Chicago, where a gentleman, Leon Botstein, who now is the president of Bard College, and he was a very serious student and violinist, and so I hung out with him and some friends and actually stayed on the couch in the student lounge. And I would go to the art student, the art department, just stop working. People thought I was an art student. And I would travel around the country just visiting.
You would do nothing to dispel this notion right. that you were an art student.
I'd just walk in with pencils and a pad, and there'd be a life drawing course. I'd sit there and just start drawing. And later on, there'd be a painting course, and I'd just, you know, stretch a canvas and start painting. And there'd be a live model. And I would stay there for a couple of weeks. And a friend of mine was driving into Boston and said, hey, you know, I hear there's a great art school there. You want to check it out? And I said, great. And I walked in and brought in some paintings, and they said there was a, you know, $10 fee or something. I went back to my friends in the car. I said, can you borrow $10? And I put this application in. About 3 weeks later, I was out in Chicago, and I called home just to let everyone know I was still alive and well. And my mom said, you know, you got this letter from this place up in Boston. So I said, open it up, and I got this scholarship. So I headed out to Boston. I had really no money. I had about, I think, $20 on me. And I
this
got,
is what, it's like 65?
This is 64, I think.
64, okay.
64, 60, maybe.
And you're a teenager still.
Yeah. And so the first night I stayed at this place called the Huntington Avenue Hotel. And this was a small little room, and with this flashing sign, Huntington, Huntington. And, you know, to the left and right of me were these, like, hacking, you know, TB coughs and, you know.
This is a scary Tom Waits song, this room.
No, this is the room, you know. And, you know, the Gideon's Bible stuck together. It was and the next night I stayed at, across the street, there was a YMCA, one of these rooms where, you know, you can sleep with six or seven people, and that got a little scary, and so it was going to be in the park the next night. I knew it, and so I was in the school looking on the walls for roommates. And these signs say roommates, roommates wanted, roommates needed, and this fella came up to me and said, yo, looking for a roommate? I said, yeah. I said, oh, well, I got a place. And I said, cool. And he said, you want to move in? I said, sure. And that was David Lynch.
Isn't that wild?
And we lived in a room that was maybe 4x4 with a bunk bed, a tiny kitchen, and just like a toilet.
And he was going to school there?
He was going to school. He was coming up from Alexandria, Virginia. He was studying painting. I was studying painting. And it was like water and oil. I mean, he was the painting and his music. And plus David, who's now known to be very eclectic and very left to center, was pretty always dressed up in a suit, you know, and kind of
really.
Oh yeah, and his music was pretty traditional, the top 40 stuff. And I was kind of at that time, you know, listening to Thelonious Monk and crazy stuff, and you know, Reverend Gary Davis and all these crazy things. And so I was an insomniac, still am. So David get to sleep like about 1 o'clock, and I was just starting to wake up at 1 o'clock. Uh-huh. And you know, in this little room, we were like in a little prison cell. So finally, after several months of not being able to pay the rent, David thought it would be best he go his way and I go mine.
So in other words, you got kicked out by David Lynch.
I got kicked out by David Lynch. He thought I was a little too crazy. And so one day I actually came back and the door was locked. The key had been changed.
Ooh.
And that was kind of dramatic. So trying to be inventive, I figured, well, man, I got all my paintings and I got all my Thelonious Monk records, and that guy wants his, you know, his money. And so I had a friend with a one-ton truck, and we drove in the back alley, and I climbed up the fire escape, and I knew the windows would be open. I came in the windows, and I started carrying down some of my paintings and things. And just as I'm down on my last trip, I had like all my Blue Note records underneath my arm. All of a sudden, these flashlights fly on me, and these, you know, all of a sudden, there's like 30 policemen. Freeze! Yeah. And they have these guns and rifles, and I, you know, woo, mercy, hands go up, and I say, don't shoot. Don't shoot. You know, it's my records. You know, I'm just... It turned out that they were doing a stakeout for the Boston Strangler, who they had
a... Oh, my God.
...tip
wow.
was going to strike in that area. And they thought I could be the Boston Strangler. Well, that was my first visit to the police station.
I'm beginning to see now where this very autobiographical song on your album called The Cold Heart of the Stone gets its title from.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
where we used to stay. We played all night, we slept all day. We'd set them up, we'd shoot them down. There was something lost, there was something found that kept us warm as we stood alone near the cold.
Is it safe to say, Peter Wolf, that this is the most autobiographical writing you've done on this album?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. This is the album I've been trying to make for a very long time. And, you know, it's sort of like cooking. You know, you try it, and you try the recipe, and you try it, and sometimes you go astray, and you realize, maybe a little too much, chili con carne in that one. And then you say, I got it. Mm. And this was a record that... I was thinking a lot, and I realized that the music that really means so much to me is when there's a credibility between the singer and the song, where there's a sort of where you can believe the singer and song. And even if the person didn't write the song, like Sinatra never wrote a song, but if you hear, One for My Baby, One More for the Road, the Johnny Mercer song, it's Sinatra. Mm-hmm. There's something in there that transcends. And growing up and even coming out of the era with Dylan and the Stones, when the Stones were writing songs that were about their lifestyles and getting involved in many of the early country things, and most especially the blues artists. When I first saw Muddy Waters, and matter of fact, the gentleman who let me in upstairs reminded me there's a PBS special on Muddy Waters, I guess this week, that we taped down in Kennedy Center in Washington with Buddy Guy and Coco Taylor and some of Muddy's old band and G. Smith and John Hyatt and Gomo and a whole bunch of people.
Well, when Muddy would come to Boston back in the 60s, you hung with him and like actually sort of worked with him and worked, not necessarily even musically, but just kind of like...
Well, I was like his unofficial valet.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I would hang out, and I remember when he first came, I was sitting on the stoop, and he was playing this little club, and I just waited all day, and finally this big Cadillac comes up with this little trailer on the back. And there was the great Muddy Waters. And this man was one of the most handsome men I've ever seen. And he got out, and he was all dressed up in a suit. And they just traveled all the way from Chicago to Boston. And, I just said, I'm Mr. Waters, and oh, it's a pleasure, and blah, 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 blah. And they were carrying the amps in, so I started carrying the amps. And we were playing this club, and the club had a very tiny dress room. So Muddy used the dress room in the band, which was Otis Spann and James Cotton and S.P. Leary, some of the great blues greats, was this little bathroom, and they were hanging in the bathroom. I heard, Otis Spann and James Cotton talking about, man, wish we can get something to drink. Muddy catches us, he'll kill us. I said, well, I can get you something to drink. He said, you can. I said, yeah. I said, what do you want? He said, well, scotch.
this white kid in the middle of this room with these heavy-duty black blues musicians. He's like, I can get some scotch for you.
So I run down the store and get scotch, and these guys are talking about, man, we got, we're here for like, 2 weeks. We're going to go crazy hanging here. And I said, well, I got an apartment 2 blocks away. And he goes, you do? And he said, yeah. I said, come on by. So Cotton and Otis Spann come by, and Cotton said, man, this is cool. Do you mind if we come back later? I said, no. So Cotton comes back with a whole big mess of chicken, and he starts cooking up, and he invites the whole band. Next day, they bring Muddy, and they start using my place as the base of operations.
Wow.
So.
And again, this is pre-Jay Giles band.
Oh, yeah.
You're just hanging.
I'm 16 and a half, 17, and there's Muddy Waters sitting in my apartment, and... you know, and he was a boxer. And this guy was, I'm telling you, and he'd sit down and, you know, ask him these questions. And I have tapes. I had a reel-to-reel, and I started taping. You know, Muddy would tell me, well, you know, I'm a harmonica player, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I would start asking him about, you know, how he first heard about, you know, Son House and, you know, Robert Johnson and the whole, how it all came, how he came to be into Chicago. And they would all be cooking and sitting around and yakking and talking. And so every time they came into the area, I would just be there. And they would call me. I had a telephone number. It was called Flip 313. And all the musicians, be it Van Morrison or Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker, they'd get into town and dial Flip 313.
They all knew your number.
Yeah, and they would come by. And because it was a place where they can hang out, they can relax, I had all the records, you know, everybody's records. And I remember, you know, playing these old, you know, Aristocrat records for Muddy, and you, man, I haven't heard that, and play it again. And, you know, I'd ask him about Little Walter.
Peter, hold the thought of Van. Because the Van you're talking about is Van Morrison.
Right.
We got to pause here, take care of some commercial business, and tell me about your relationship with Van back in those days.
Hi, I'm David Byrne, and I've never hosted anything before except maybe some dinner parties. But this year I'm hosting this season of Sessions at West 54th, serving you the best in contemporary music each and every week.
Join host David Byrne for 26 weeks of stunning up-close performances by the most acclaimed artists of a generation, only on public television. Lou Reed, Elvis Costello, Burt Bacharach, Lucinda Williams, Cowboy Junkies, The Pat Metheny Group, John Hyatt, Kronos Quartet, Natalie Merchant, Nadeski, Martin and Wood, Lyle Lovett, The Lounge Lizards, Liz Phair, Neil Finn, and many more. See why New York Magazine said it may be the best contemporary music show ever. Sessions at West 54. It's critically acclaimed. It's commercial free. It's the way music looks now. Made possible by IBM, BMW, and DirecTV.
This week, John Mellencamp and Randy Newman. Sundays at 11 on 13 and Mondays at midnight on WLIW 21.
Every mattress company says they have the lowest price, the best service, and the largest selection. Can you guarantee me it's the real deal?
Sure. Nobody knows mattresses better than Sleepy's. Just call 1-800-SLEEPYS and you'll get speedy delivery. And we guarantee it.
Or you can visit any one of over 130 Sleepy's stores and pick the mattress that's right for you.
That's right. We have over 130 stores. And because we sell more mattresses than anyone on the East Coast, you get great prices. Guaranteed.
And it's the real deal. Sleepy's will beat any price or you get the mattress free plus $500 cash.
And I got 60 days to sleep on it. I know it's the right mattress for me.
That's the amazing 60-day comfort guarantee, only from Sleepy's.
It's a fact. When you need a mattress, Sleepy's is the real deal. Call 1-800-SLEEPYS for delivery or stop in and see us. Sleepy's, the real deal.
Guaranteed.
The Sleepy's guarantee. You can sleep on it.
Hey, what's that on your chin? And there's something on your nose. Actually, there's stuff all over your face. Don't worry, it's not crumbs from a late afternoon cupcake. It's the gunk left by your not-so-cleansing cleanser. See, Biore cleansers don't just move dirt around your face. Biore gets rid of dirt. The Biore Dirt Lock system surrounds oil and makeup so they rinse away completely, leaving absolutely clean skin. So wash your face with Biore cleansers and smile. Just check for spinach in your teeth. Biore. Clean. Honest.
All right, now let me tell you some of the things that are upcoming at the Bottom Line over the next few days and weeks. Wednesday and Thursday this week, it's Dave Davies' Kink Chronicles, along with the Paul Ruderman Band. And then on Friday, it's Required Listening, a no-risk evening of discovery, featuring this time around Mary Cucciarfello, Ulu Dara, Kristen Hirsch, and Rustic Overtones with host Rita Houston. Saturday, January 30th, it's North of the Border with Blue Rodeo, Tom Wilson, and the Angstones. And then it's February. And as you know, February is Bottom Line anniversary time. Thursday, February 4th, Dan Byrne and Jill Sobule will be at the club. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, February 5th, 6th, and 7th, it's the return of, for a very rare three-performance-only gig, the David Bromberg Band. David Bromberg coming in from Chicago and getting his whole band flying in from all around the country to play the Bottom Line on February 5th, 6th, and 7th. David Olney will be on the bill as well. There will be one show only each night. So that's the David Bromberg Band, who for many years always played the actual anniversary of the bottom line. Right around like the 13th or 14th, somewhere in there was the actual anniversary. The 12th was the actual day that the bottom line opened 25 years ago. And Bromberg hasn't been around for a while. He's basically retired, but he's coming out of retirement, performance retirement, to play the bottom line with his big band on February 5th, 6th, and 7th. Tish Hinojosa will be at the club on February 10th. Jimmy Webb and Susan Werner on February 11th. Tuck and Patty will be there on February 19th doing an all-request show. Marshall Crenshaw will be there on Saturday, February 20th. Here's something that we're announcing for the first time tonight. Joe Ely on Sunday, February 21st. That damn Alan Pepper keeps booking the shows that I desperately want to see for Sunday nights. Sunday night, February 21st, Joe Ely at the bottom line. And then there's that Sunday, the very last Sunday of the month is the, that's the night that Graham Parker and Southside Johnny are at the club. So the Bacon Brothers will be there on February 22nd. Here's a new one, David Johansen. Oh, now listen to this. David Johansen as David Johansen, which means that's not Buster. That's David Johansen. When he's billed as David Joe, that means a whole different show and a whole different attitude. David Johansen with a group called the Harry Smiths. I don't know who's in the Harry Smiths, but Peter Wolf, I'm sure, somewhere in that vast collection of vinyl that he was attempting to take down the fire escape from David Lynch's apartment back in 1964, had that Harry Smith anthology of folk music, I'm sure.
Sure done.
David Johansen with the Harry Smiths on Thursday, February 25th, and Loudon Wainwright III will be at the club on February 26th. Doing a show called the NPR Songs, which means the topical songs that he's written over the years for National Public Radio. Being topical songs, they have a very short shelf life. They generally get played once or twice during the course of a newscast, and then they disappear. Well, he will revive a whole bunch of those songs on February 26th. And then on the 28th, it's that Southside Johnny acoustic show along with Graham Parker to celebrate the 25th anniversary of The Bottom Line, which is located at 15 West 4th Street in the heart of the Village. 212-228-6300, that's the number to call for information.